You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode 10, Borderlands of Canaan. So last week we didn't get a chance to cover everything we wanted to cover. So this is part two. We wanted to talk a little bit about podcasting. Canaan, you've been doing this podcasting thing for a really, really long time. I remember you on, I think, MacBreak Weekly, and there was
This Week in Media.
This Week in Media, right.
Before we met.
So did you do stuff before that, or is that sort of how you stumbled onto it?
Well, I'd been doing, so on and off, I'd been doing a few podcasts here and there. It's funny, MacBreak Weekly is a funny thing. I was never officially on MacBreak Weekly. The thing that I really started doing big time was, there was a show called This Week in Media. And at the time, I'm trying to remember, I don't remember what year that was, 2006, 2007 maybe?
I want to say 2006. I can actually look that up on my iTunes, because I kept those old episodes.
Yeah, I'm sure it was somewhere in that range. And so I'd been on the show for a while, and we were trying to, there was a period of time when basically John Foster, Kenji Kato, Craig Severson, and there was one other person who was sort of bouncing around on the show, and Alex decided that he wanted to change the format from experts in visual effects to This Week in Media-based news, where media is loosely defined as anything that's on the internet and may or may not have something moving inside of it.
The format seemed to change from something that was very much, well, not necessarily inside baseball with the negative connotation, but much more techie-oriented, much more, these are the people who create things, this is what they're talking about, into something that was much more marketing-oriented. The vibe that I got from it was, it was interesting. I mean, it certainly had a lot of really good information, but it was entirely different from what it used to be. It was talking about ComScore and basically all the statistics and the marketing and the ad sales surrounding websites, which, while interesting on a, you know, 5 minutes kind of level, it just wasn't interesting or compelling.
Right. Yeah, it got a little weird there for a while. So there were a lot of format changes and a lot of attempts to make it something slightly different than industry experts talking about film. And I think the big reason for that was at the time there was another show called The VFX Show,
mm-hmm.
which was in partnership with the FX Guide folks over there. You know, Mike Seymour was involved. And I know John Montgomery and Jeff Huser are part of the FX PhD FX Guide crew, but only Mike Seymour was involved in the VFX Show, as far as I can recall. And so I think there was an attempt to split This Week in Media and the VFX Show into their own separate entities. And so This Week in Media became much more about, I want to say the idea was content or media creation, but I mean, you listen to it, it sort of turned into, like you said, ComScore and CPM and a lot of other different things.
Right. I think so, some of that came out of, that the show ended up talking a lot about where big media was going during the earlier days and stuff, and which format's dead, and this format's dead, and that format's dead. And that kind of led towards that media as TV, film, video, internet thing.
Well, there was a running meme of, have you cut your cable cord yet? And are you only watching television via the internet?
Right.
And that seemed to raise its head every week. And it's like,
but yeah, we're all edge cases.
You know, right, exactly.
The poorest representation of a metric ever. I mean, right. I'm not saying that the show fostered that. Right. I'm just saying it was a bunch of edge cases talking about other people. You know, and then the flip side of that is the ComScore stuff was all metrics. So it was like one extreme or the other.
Yeah. And so Alex brought in several people. I think he was trying to find the right voice for the show. And originally he had told me that he thought that I might be the voice for the show.
Well, you've got a good voice.
Well, I appreciate that. But we had a slightly different perspective on what This Week in Media should become. That's not to say one of us was right or wrong. It's just to say that I was right.
You're an asshole, as we've established, right?
Right. Yes. Well, I believe we've established I'm a weapons grade asshole. So if you're going to go there, at least go there proficiently and accurately.
I'll use your full title from now on. John Kanenthaler. And I've been weapons grade asshole.
Which, of course, now we've got the title for this show, which is, weapons grade asshole.
Well, I've recently been knighted, so I would appreciate sir with a great asshole.
Just knighted by whom?
The king of weapon grade assholes. I mean,
clearly. So right. I was going to say, so if you were merely the knight of weapons grade assholes,
I guess I'd just be king of assholes.
Who would be? Yeah. Who there? Therefore, who would be the king of weapons grade assholes? Pay no attention.
We'll leave
that
to the right. We'll leave that to the listeners to discover on their own with a quick DuckDuckGo search, since they're all the 1% hipsters.
Right. God.
So yeah. Right. So anyway, there was a little bit of a disagreement about the direction, disagreement is probably not the right way of phrasing it, because, you know, at the time we were trying to figure out what does this look like. And so it was a lot of speculation about what podcasting was so new, and we weren't really sure where the footing was. And Alex was on this road to 1080p, I don't know, you know, tilting at windmills, is that what it's called?
We discussed that before, actually.
Yeah, four years too early for 1080p. I mean, my poor machine could not render that in Flash. It could actually do it if it were a QuickTime file, but the second you put it into a Flash wrapper, it was all bets are off.
Right. Well, and I would argue that machines still, if you had a 1080p, if you had a true full res 1080p, you know, 24 or 30 frame per second video wrapped in Flash right now, even the machine that I have, CPUs would be going crazy. Fans would come on. It's
yeah.
Not only that, we all sort of discovered that, you know, 720p is not really bad.
It's not really bad, but I can certainly see the difference between 1080 and 720.
Oh, you can see the difference. I mean, it's you, but right. Yeah, you can see the difference.
Well, also the big difference is that, you know, 1080p is not 1080p is not 1080p. I mean, if you've got 1080p, like at an H.264 1080p at, you know, 300 kbit per second, that's going to look like arse. And if it's at, you know, 5 megabit per second, that's going to look pretty good. So,
right, and there were so few tools. But you know, the level of control that you have now and the new additions to the compression are so much better.
Like I said, this was really early, so things were going in a lot of different directions. And one of the directions, as you recall, was I decided that it would be fun to do a video podcast, not delivered in 1080p, but a video podcast called That Media Show. And the idea behind That Media Show was kind of a throwback to the things that I imagined would be really good if This Week in Media had actually ever done them, which was this idea of sort of an insider, very technical version of, you know, what's going on right now. So it was discussion about the Red Camera. I'm sure, Maggie, I'm sure you've seen them.
Yes, I enjoyed them all. I really enjoyed the show a lot.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. So there were big question marks at the time around, was That Media Show competing with This Week in Media? I mean, they certainly both had the word media in the title, but they were completely different shows. And then the VFX show, was that competing with This Week in Media? Because This Week in Media started out as a, you know, the tagline, even when I left the show, the tagline was still industry experts talking about, you know, current, what's new in film or something like that. I mean, it was, you know, it was still that original tagline from when Foster and those guys were on it.
Right. I always saw those shows as panel shows, you know, in the British vernacular. It's a panel show. And your show was more of a, for lack of a better term, it was a news show. It was a highlights show. It was, you know, it was the extra of video, you know, effects.
Right. Yeah. I one of the reviewers jokingly referred to it as like Access for, Access Hollywood for nerds or something like that.
You know, well, it sounds bad, but it is kind of fair. I mean, you know, it is, you know, every industry or every division of media has that kind of thing. And that was kind of what it was. But I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing, except for it's comparing to something which is obviously horrible.
Right.
Well, you know what? It's not necessarily horrible. I mean, it's horrible to us because we're not a part of that, you know, goading on celebrity type stuff. But, you know, people who work with cool stuff like Red cameras or Arri cameras or what have you, and actually make these things, those are our celebrities. So I think it's valid. I think the comparison is valid.
Minus the gossipy aspects.
Well, it was a little gossipy. I mean, and it was sort of intentionally tongue in cheek. So it came out weekly, and it was about a 6 to 10 minute show, depending on how much time I had. And I wrote every single line of the copy, and then I had three different hosts. The first one was Darren Criss, who is now the main character in the other school on the TV show Glee. And the second host was Laura Lee, who I am currently married to. And the third host was Morgan Cullen, who was, I think she's the host of Runway Daily on MTV or something like that. So it was kind of interesting that I managed to find these people who went on to do other things, but who were also, you know, willing to go on this crazy little ride with me. So I wrote it, I shot it. It was all shot on green screen, and I produced a show every week. And now it may not sound like much, 5 minutes, 10 minutes every week, but as a part-time gig that's not really generating revenue, the idea of sitting down and writing 10 minutes of news copy, if you're familiar with, there's a show on Hulu called The Morning After.
I'm not familiar with it.
What's a Hulu?
Right. So there's a show on Hulu called The Morning After, which some people may or may not be familiar with. Rather than once a week, it's every day. But, you know, they have a team of people working on this. And here I was, just this sort of lone, you know, gunman, as it were, writing and directing and doing all the visual effects and all of these other things.
The Ted Kaczynski of media video.
Right. Exactly. Right. Locked into a cabin, you know, using Shake or After Effects or whatever I was using at the time. I mean, I went through a lot of different software packages until I found the workflow that really did work for me. Anyway, that was a tremendous amount of work, and it was sort of unsustainable for a single person to do that. So not to go too far down this, but so one of the things that happened is I actually had an offer to put that show on the air nightly by a major network.
Wow.
And they wanted to change a bunch of things, and they, you know, it was pretty good money and all that. The thing that I realized, though, was I realized that once a week was damn near killing me.
Right.
So there was no way once a night for five minutes a night, there's no way that was going to happen. I mean, I would have just come unraveled. Well, so I chose to abandon the show at that point rather than, you know, make that choice. Or rather than make any choice, because it was already starting to weigh on me. And the funny thing about the show, too, is I don't know if you know this, but you know Life Zero, the podcast that I did as well? Mm-hmm. The Life Zero podcast never reached the number of subscribers that that media show had.
Well, it was a very different show. I mean, not everyone, I'm not certain that Life Zero would have the same audience. You know, I can't imagine that there would be as much of an audience or as much of a pool necessarily.
Right. But, you know, it's video. And so to Maggie's point about it, or to everyone's point about maybe it's not such a bad thing to call it Access Hollywood for geeks or nerds or whatever. The point about the audience, I think, is absolutely correct, right? Which is that there was a shockingly large audience for something that I thought, you know, was a very tiny group of people that would be interested in it.
Hey, it sounded like you've got a hit because, yes, it's that sort of niche audience. But it seemed to me that it was in a easily digestible format. It was video, so people are obviously naturally going to gravitate toward video. And obviously you got, you know, network buy-in. There was clearly something, you know, it had legs, obviously. And the only problem was is that you were doing it by yourself, which made it impossible to maintain and keep your sanity.
Right. And I realized with a crew of people around me, it still would have been, I don't know. I think it probably is a weekly show, you know, or a bi-weekly show. I just think a nightly show would have killed it. You know, it's the same way that you watch a television series and you think to yourself, okay, X-Files, after season 4, do we really have anything left to say? I mean, are we just going to beat the viewer into submission until they remember hating this show?
Yeah, even now, I couldn't see it as a nightly. I mean, if someone else were doing it, a weekly show, yeah, and maybe, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, but nightly show, no.
Well, the other aspect of it is that, you know, because you're talking about the technology and you're talking about the people behind it, it's simply not that fast. You know, nothing really changes every day.
Right.
Back then it did because The Red was announcing something every 18 seconds. And so.
Right, but they weren't actually releasing anything ever.
So you could just bring up the next rumor the next day and it'd be fine.
Right. Since our last installment of that media show, Red has announced 7 products, canceled 2, and prototyped 1.
and revamped six of them and canceled, then suddenly canceled the rest of them.
And posts have come up and gone, and pricing has changed four times.
Yes.
All right. Always talk to you tomorrow. So right around the same time, I did a show called That Post Show. And the idea between that media show and that post show was that that media show would be the media version of it, right? The visual. And that post show would be the audio version, right? So it was kind of this fun little play on words that I thought where there would be complimentary podcasts.
Right.
And that post show obviously is still going. I mean, I did take a 2-year break when I was traveling and in the middle of Europe or Mexico or Central America or wherever I wasn't doing that post show. But I did bring it back. So I was just trying to think about, you were asking about shows and podcasts and things. You know, it's funny. I thought the other day it would be fun to just list all the podcasts that I've been on my website. So someone could go to my website and look at my CV and go, oh, he's been on these podcasts. And I got to about 30 different ones. And I just thought, that's enough. I mean, there's no real point in this. And it's funny because some of them I didn't even remember until I was looking at them. Like I was on Typical Mac User a while ago talking about iMovie. I mean, this was years ago.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Because you've been on so many. Do you even remember all of them? Or was it just off the top of your head type of stuff?
Yeah, I was Googling and looking around and trying to remember. And, you know, it just became crazy. And then the other thing I was thinking is a long time ago, 2005, 2006 maybe, when I was at the search engine that I mentioned before, the one that was acquired by the co-founder of Ask.com, well, originally Ask Jeeves, now Ask.com, mm-hmm. For the company that I'd started, I did a video podcast where I had every single person in the company talk about what they did and what they were excited about and what they thought the technology should be used for. And we were posting that as well. And I think for a while that was actually in iTunes. Trying to remember, it was either in iTunes or it was available on the website exclusively. But anyway, we were talking about early 2006, like late 2005, early 2006. So when you say I've been podcasting for a while, well, it's certainly not Adam Curry long, but, you know, long enough.
I was going to say, because 2006 was certainly before, I guess it was the first big push where the technologies finally started to get good enough. And people started taking it seriously enough. Yeah, I mean, obviously, Adam Curry, I mean, he kind of created the word podcast. So, you know, he's been doing that pretty seriously for a while. Yeah, I remember, you know, the nascent Leo stuff and the stuff coming out of Pixel Core as well, or the Pixel Core affiliated shows, I should say. I mean, there was a bunch of them all at once. And that seemed to be where people started taking it seriously.
I think about different kinds of podcasts, and I think about, let's say, a podcast like This Week in Tech versus a podcast like Ruining It for Everyone or You Look Nice Today or even Scruffy Thinking, right, which I do. The This Week in Tech, you know, it's basically like, okay, hit record. All right, blah, 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 blah. Unless something goes wrong, then you chop that out. And then, you know, it's all built in. It's just like a radio show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stop recording.
Yeah.
Do some post-processing. Run it through to make it sound better or fix the levels and then squirt that thing out.
Can we do that?
That is what we do.
Versus the stuff that you guys do, the stuff that You Look Nice Today did, the stuff that I do. I mean, my podcasts, for example, and I can't speak to yours, but I'm guessing it's similar. If we record for 2 hours, so an average Scruffy Thinking is a 2 or 3 hour recording.
Mm-hmm.
The one that gets released is typically between an hour and an hour and a half long.
Yep.
Pretty much.
So that's about half of the audio that gets edited out. Also, I try and edit out a lot of ums and uhs and long, slow, uncomfortable silences and all of these other different things. And there are some conversations which, you know, just don't work, right? So you cut those out, you know, and we're doing all this work. But I was thinking, you know, for me to edit a 3-hour, if I record for 3 hours, to edit that is probably 4 hours.
Yeah,
it's a long time.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a little bit over half again as long as the show is. So if you've got a 3-hour show, a 3-hour record, recording, then it'll take roughly 5 hours to fully go through and edit.
And that's about right. I usually set aside the better part of a day each week to edit to edit a podcast. So yeah, about 5 hours. That's a lot. That's a lot of work. And what's funny about that is when I was doing that media show, you know, it was visual effects and it was all on green screen. So none of the sets were real and it was edited together. And, you know, that was always 12 to 15 hours of work for a 5 to 7 minute show, 5 to 10 minute show.
But I tell you what, the production values on the show really sold it. And I think a lot of people coming to it fresh would have probably initially thought, oh, wow, where did this must have been on for ages. I'm sure this is immensely popular. And where and how did I miss this? Because it looked like something that was, you know, being put out by a larger unit. Something, it was very slick. It was very nice.
It was that show, and there were a few others that made me interested in trying to do this and learning more about it and all that, where, you know, again, those production values were so high. It was like, wow, okay, these guys are pretty much doing it on their own, and yet the production values are still really, really high, you know, near broadcast quality stuff, you know, now that the technology is available to do it. And along with that, there's almost no excuse to do it poorly. You know, for a few hundred bucks investment, you can sound very good or look very good, rather than, you know, using the microphone that's built into your laptop, for example.
And I should point out, I'm also including, you know, the video shows. Production value was very important, I think, to them as well.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I appreciate that. You know, it's funny you talk about for $200, anyone can have a setup. So, for example, for $200, you could buy the Rode podcast mic. Now, you need an arm for that because you got to get right up on it. Or for $150 to $200, you could buy the Blue Yeti, which is what I'm speaking on right now. And so you can sound pretty good, absolutely, and I agree with that. The thing that's weird to me, though, is that there are so many podcasts that don't take advantage of that, right? There are some very popular podcasts that... So there's one called PlayStation Nation. So I recently picked up a PlayStation 3. I think I mentioned this before. Larlee's, one of her Christmas presents was I picked up a PlayStation 3 for her. There was a Black Friday sale where there was a PlayStation 3, and it was bundled with Little Big Planet 2 and Ratchet and Clank 4.
Cool.
And Little Big Planet I love so much.
Right. So Little Big Planet and Ratchet and Clank are her two favorite games, and this was bundled with them, and I thought, this is fantastic. And, you know, we'd been traveling and I hadn't really had a PlayStation and all this stuff. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to catch up, right? It's been 2.5 years since I've had a PlayStation. You know, what's going on? So I downloaded a podcast called PlayStation Nation, which is apparently the number one most popular PlayStation podcast on iTunes. Because I'm such a weapons grade asshole, I lasted not even 7 minutes before I had to turn it off because the amount of noise, the production value was so low, I couldn't listen to it. And I keep thinking, you know, the people who are playing PlayStation probably don't care, right? They're probably just like, all right, well, I'll listen to these guys talk about it.
Yeah, it's kind of like the YouTube/MP3 audio thing that people talk about. Oh, well, you know, there's a certain generation of people, and it's not really generational. It's more groups of people. They listen to all this lower quality music and they're fine with it, you know. And that's, I sometimes reassure Christopher, you know, when we're all like, oh, I don't know, that it's so good. Well, like, you know, it sounds a lot better than the other stuff on the web. Because I know exactly where you're coming from. You'll get some podcasts and it's six people on janky headphones with a boom mic, you know.
Right.
And it's awful.
Right. Just janking it up as hard as they can with, you know, the worst possible audio.
And it's interesting that PlayStation Nation is, you know, has such awful production values, but it must be that the content is very, very good despite that. Or again, maybe they just don't know any better. You know, it just happens to be that that audience doesn't get exposed to the greater, you know, higher level podcasts that are available.
I was just going to say, I don't want to come off like a jerk because, you know, I mean, good on them, right, for having a popular PlayStation podcast. And I mean, I have no ill will toward them. I wish them the most success in the world. It's like five guys sitting around rapping about PlayStation games and stuff, and that's fantastic. I just find it unlistenable.
I mean, and if you've ever listened to like in-game chatter, you know, it's like listening to people peel paint off the wall with chainsaws, kind of what I was getting at earlier. I think there's a certain element of, you know, what's acceptable to you in certain situations. And there are a lot of people who don't care what a podcast sounds like, but a little effort goes a long way, I think.
In a similar vein, there's another gaming podcast that I used to listen to. I don't listen to anymore because I don't play the game, but I used to be a World of Warcraft player. One of the reasons why I got into the game was this podcast called The Instance, which was the number one World of Warcraft podcast. And
I've heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really well done. They do something really bizarre, which is they've got their main segment and then they tack on outsourced segments as well at the end. So they'll have like little guest segments that are 1 or 2 minutes at the end. The main segment, you know, is definitely of a much higher production value. They do a lot of inserts. They do a lot of beds. They have, you know, segments that they go in and out of. It was really quite well done. Even though I wasn't playing the game at the time, I was listening to it because they had such passion for the game itself. B, the quality, the audio quality was superb. And when I finally did start playing the game, it made more sense. But even when I stopped playing the game after I was just done with it, I continued to follow them because, again, they still had that passion and it was a pleasure to listen to.
I'm currently playing a game called Borderlands, or as you would say, Borderlands.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've played the game, but your mention of World of Warcraft made me think of it. So Borderlands is like, it's a first-person shooter action role-playing game. It's very cartoonish. It looks like World of Warcraft, very much like World of Warcraft. So it's a combination. If you took Halo and World of Warcraft and you slammed them together into 7,000 tons of awesome, it would be Borderlands. It's literally the most engaging, most fun game that I've ever played because I'm a big fan of role-playing games, and I certainly lost more than my fair share of time to World of Warcraft.
When did you stop playing, by chance?
So I started playing and I stopped playing within 7 weeks.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah. So basically, I started playing. I took a break in, let's see, it would have been 2006. Okay. So I just sold my company in the end of 2006, and I'd sold it in October, and then I had some time between November and January, and I started playing it while I was working on the screenplay for Jake Forgotten. I remember Larlee and I staying home for most of the 2-week Christmas break, leveling up our characters or going to the coffee shop and just playing. So there was about a 2-week period where when I wasn't writing the screenplay, I was just playing World of Warcraft.
That's usually how it starts.
Yeah. So I think I was like level 42, 43, something like that. And I just went, you know what? That's enough.
Yeah. It's highly, highly addictive. And it's also based on Vegas rules where, you know, they give you just enough carrots to keep going. It's like, oh, well, you know, if I play for 5 more minutes, I can get this thing. If I play for 5 more minutes more, I can get this thing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Soon it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you've failed all your finals and you've been fired from your work and, oh, horribleness.
So glad I never played.
Yes. So Borderlands.
Although I do have Borderlands too.
Oh. So
I became completely obsessed with the auction house in World of Warcraft.
Yes.
And spent so much time buying and selling and moving things through the auction house. That's one of the reasons I didn't level up as much as I could have. But the reason Borderlands does that, it has that same kind of pellet of crack adrenaline rush for me is the number. So I don't know if you know anything about the way that the weapons work in Borderlands, but it's phenomenal. The weapons themselves have all of these attributes. Each of the attributes has multiple ways in which that attribute can be manifest. And so a weapon, for example, might have 10 or 12 attributes, and each of those attributes have multiple levels, and then the weapon itself can be multiple levels. So you have that kind of, you know, World of Warcraft where you have like shoddy armor up all the way to epic armor.
Right.
We have the weapons in the same way. And then each character has a skill tree, just like World of Warcraft, where you can be, for example, I play the hunter because, you know.
Because yes.
Because going into Jacob's Cove with nothing but a pistol and taking out 10,000 zombies is my idea of getting rid of a bad mood.
Right on.
Have you played the Zombie Island of Dr. Ned yet?
Yeah, that's awesome. I was literally just playing Jacob's Cove before I got on this podcast nice. With nothing but a pistol.
By the way, I don't know if you remember, I bought your Xbox before you left. I still have Laura's pink controller. I got rid of the Xbox, but I still have her pink controller if she ever wants it back.
Nice.
I had forgotten about that. Yeah, you bought that, and it came with Borderlands, did it not? Or no, Borderlands hadn't come out yet.
No. I got Borderlands when PlayStation, you know, screwed up so bad. They gave away some free games. That's when I got Borderlands.
Oh, man. So, anyway, not that this is a podcast about Borderlands, but it is a podcast about media and things that are done very awesomely. Borderlands is on that list big time.
See, now I got to go seek it out. I've heard of the game, but I knew nothing about it.
And I got it just because it looks so cool, because it's very cartoony and it's right. A lot of cell shading and stuff.
Oh, cool, cool.
That's why I only buy games because they look. I can't play them.
Right. There's actually, I don't know if you saw my, just one last thing about Borderlands. I don't know if you saw my Twitter stream today, but there's this really interesting guy who hacks region encoding on DVD players. And he has a lot of work that he's done to try and make things region free. And he's a Mac guy. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he wrote this tool. So basically on the PC side, there's a tool called Willow Tree that lets you edit your save files in Borderlands.
Oh.
And he wrote something called Border Tool, which lets you edit it on the Mac. Now, there's something interesting about the editor. So on the Windows side, the editor is just like, oh, select the, you know, type of weapon and we'll automatically fill in all the values. And then you can, move sliders around. And Border Tool is more like go to the modding site and figure out what the internal name for this weapon is and then jack with the plist. And then save it back. Now, the cool thing about Borderlands is I think that the guys knew that you would do this because the worst case scenario, if you bring a weapon that's completely hacked into the game, all the game does is it just vanishes the weapon from your inventory.
Oh, well, interesting. So there's got to be some sort of server-side checksum to see if a particular value is valid for the weapon.
Right. And remember, it's multiple values. Like,
well, right.
I mean, it's just a series of these crazy strings with underscores. And I mean, it's pretty intense. But I like, I like Border Tool because it appeals more to the hacker in me, the more of the, you know.
You have to work at it.
And I can make something that the sliders don't give me because as good as those sliders are, they're not always right. For example, there's an online configuration tool for the weapons in Borderlands where you can say, oh, I want something that, you know, is this level and does this kind of damage and has the incendiary property and blah, blah, blah. And a scope of this, you know, of this size and everything. Hey, look at that. They're coming after me because I'm hacking Borderlands.
Or it's the murder house again.
Yeah. Or it's the murder house again.
So you're saying this rifle goes to 11.
But exactly. The online configuration tool, though, leaves out a lot of the, you know, different weapons that you can pick up in the game and a lot of potential weapons. And so the other cool thing about Borderlands, this is the last thing I'll say about it, I promise. The two of us could both play all the way through and neither of us would have a gun that was the same.
Right.
Right.
It's pretty cool.
Because the guns they're basically randomly generated properties on these guns.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. A lot of, I think it was, you know, I think Diablo was one of the ones that did that as well.
Yes.
Right. Oh, God, did I waste a lot of time playing those games?
Well, wait till you play Borderlands. And you should play it now because Borderlands 2 comes out this year. So you'll have an opportunity to play the hell out of Borderlands and then be like, roll right into Borderlands 2.
Is it on Steam? Do you know?
It is.
Uh-oh. For the Mac or do I have to build a PC in order to do it?
No, it's for the Mac as well. So for me, I picked up the disc, and my understanding is that they have a universal disc that works on Xbox and PlayStation and all that, but I don't know because the only console that I play anymore is PlayStation.
Huh.
The paying the online tax to be part of Xbox Live is so offensive to me. I can't even talk about how mad it makes me.
On the plus side, though, you're pretty much guaranteed uptime, and you know that, you know, everything will work the same way. Whereas with the PlayStation, that isn't necessarily the case. You know, no one pays for it, so it goes down a lot. And you can complain, but you can't really complain because it's free.
Right. We're so very sorry. Yeah. Now we'll talk to you in whenever it's fixed, month, two, three, whatever.
But most online experiences are essentially people standing around spawn points, sniping, and then calling you a faggot when you die anyway. And they're usually in the high-pitched, you know, hasn't quite, you know...
gotten laid.
Ever. Hasn't quite broken voice, you know, from a 13-year-old. So the online experience isn't really really my favorite anyway.
Right.
Yeah, ditto. I think the nice thing about things like Border Tools, for people like me, I'm really bad... but I want to play through stuff. So, you know, to be able to tinker and like see stuff that I'll never get. I mean, I love games, but I really am not a very good gamer. But I just finished The Seventh Guest after what, 20 freaking years?
You're kidding me.
But I mean, I haven't played it in many years. And now it's available on iPad. So I went through and I finally went through the whole thing.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, the big thing, Maggie, is... for me, okay, ignore all the hacking this or hacking that. The big thing for me is, and Borderlands isn't quite like World of Warcraft where it airdrops you in as a level one, you know, get thumped and die character. Borderlands is like, is more like Halo, right? If you're really good with a pistol and you start out with a pistol, you have a better chance of if you're totally incompetent and start out with a pistol. A lot of the skill is on the user, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a lot more like the old war shooter game. It's just like they throw you in. It's like run, 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 shoot, shoot, shoot.
Right. So it's like Unreal or like Halo or what have you. So, okay, right. That's cool.
Except it has quests and it looks gorgeous. But the one thing I would say is use Border Tool to start out with money. Because all of these games have the exact same Achilles heel, which is that it's so fucking hard to get money in these games that you can never afford anything that you find.
So here's the question then. So if the servers will vanish your weapon, will it realize that you've got too much cash and remove the cash as well? Or
No. And it only vanishes the weapon when the weapon is invalid. It doesn't vanish the weapon if the weapon is a valid configuration.
Oh, I see. Is it basically now like a totally hacked game? Because that was one of the big things about Warcraft, which was they were really, really good at stamping out bots and anything that was not... sort of a legal thing. And legal, I mean by rules, not by law.
A lot of the online game is hacked, of course. But you know, that's, again, I mean, I don't play Borderlands to go online. I mean, World of Warcraft is a much different experience because without being online, World of Warcraft is not very interesting.
Right. It basically doesn't exist. I mean, it's a very empty, sad, lonely world.
The thing that although I will... right.
You mean full stop, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you're just walking around collecting plants.
It's a sad world, full stop.
It's a sad, sad little world.
So, so sad. Picking up flowers, mining stuff, getting beaten by kobolds and all that. That's interesting. So I'm definitely going to check the game out, especially if it's on Steam, because that way I can just download it and play with it for a while.
I should verify that it's on Steam. I said that thinking it probably is. But
that's right.
I'm not 100% sure. It does use, you know, it uses the Unreal Engine, although you would never know.
Really?
It's like they took the Unreal Engine and I don't even know what happened to it. It doesn't feel like the Unreal Engine at all.
Yeah, I think a lot of work's been done on the Unreal Engine in recent years. It has to have been because there's been a couple of games like that said, oh, it's using the Unreal Engine. You're like, no way.
Yeah, I was a huge Unreal fan and Unreal Tournament and, you know, the variations therein. And I was amazed at what the home modders were able to do, let alone the people who decided to license the engine. It was well beyond basic skinning. It was, wow, I didn't even realize that was even possible, you know, to do in the game without completely programming something different.
Especially on a lot of the servers and stuff where people were doing just crazy shit with them.
Yeah, my personal favorite was whenever you altered gravity, so you'd wind up floating and then, you know, suddenly the ground would actually be the ceiling. And then you go into another room and it would be on, you know, one of the walls, and it was just, it was brilliant. But yeah, I just don't have time to play them anymore. If it's an engaging game, I wind up playing it too much and then it becomes really late and, you know, work goes to hell.
That's something that I think that is worth a brief tangent or rat hole about. I hear a lot of people say that, and it just hurts me. It like hurts my heart to hear that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, video games, I mean, there's something really, if you like playing video games, right? There's something really interesting about finding the time to play just a little bit, right? Just to keep yourself in that in that zone. And I always ask people when they say, I don't have time to play video games, I always ask, well, what are you doing that's preventing you from playing a video game?
Right.
Are you watching television? Right. There's probably some other thing that you're doing. You know, you're on Facebook, you're checking your email, you know, like a monkey dispensing a pellet. You know, you're probably doing something, right?
Well, right. Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, if you like something and you want to do it, you're going to find the time. For example, because I'm in front of a computer all the time, I go to the gym. And if I don't do that, very bad things happen in my brain if I don't go to the gym. I will find time to do that no matter what. Oh, today's busy. Well, I'm not going to be able to do this other thing because I have a prior engagement at the gym or doing this other thing or doing whatever that's really important. So I get what you're saying about that.
I try to play Robotron every week.
I heard that you built a custom controller with two joysticks just so you could play Robotron.
Yep.
Is that rumor true?
No, that rumor is true. I built a deck for playing Robotron, Stargate, and Defender.
Nice. Is it an optical joystick or is it just a regular?
Oh, leaf switches, baby.
Oh, interesting. Because it was, what was it? It was the one that actually had digitized voice, Sinistar.
Oh, Sinistar, yeah. Sinistar was a weird game.
Sinistar gave me nightmares when I was a child. That joystick was actually an optical joystick.
Yeah, it kind of had to be.
Yeah, it was every way joystick.
I am Sinistar.
So I have a tip for you if you're playing Defender, and it's something that I realized when I was younger, and it actually turns out to continue to be true.
Really? Eugene Jarvis is a god amongst men and should be elevated to the role of king of America. Oh, okay, sorry. So it must be something else.
No, it's something else. Although that's close. The if you start Heartbeat City, the album by The Cars,
right?
The minute you start your game of Defender.
Okay, hold on a second. I have to get way more high in order to continue this conversation. Keep going.
I just want to say, go on. Yes.
I'm intrigued.
The pace of the game, the shooting, the moving of Defender, of moving along with the, you know, beautiful sounds of Rick Ocasek singing along at The Cars, you know, actually matches beat for beat as you're playing. Things pass by with the beat of the music.
I have to try.
I'm totally doing
so
this.
So fantastic. So I say this having won multiple Defender tournaments while listening to Heartbeat City by The Cars. And so
right
that
on.
Just turned out, that felt like the perfect album. And I tried a lot of different albums, you know.
That is amazing.
Pet Shop Boys was a pound fail.
They usually
so
are.
So old.
But so this is another aspect of you I didn't realize. So Defender tournaments, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. That was what? That came out in 82? Wow. Good guys.
Yeah, but I started playing later because tournaments didn't really pick up until the mid-80s. Yeah, so let's see. I won a tournament playing Yar's Revenge on the Atari 2600.
Oh, that was a game I could play for days.
For which I received the game Pac-Man when it first came out on the Atari 2600.
Which is possibly the worst game ever made for the 2600.
It's not possibly.
That's true. There was the E.T. game. But yeah, no, Pac-Man was interesting.
I don't know. Pac-Man was horrible. It was so embarrassingly bad.
Yeah, well, but it was interesting, though, because they couldn't have as many sprites on the screen as they actually did. So if you notice, some of the ghosts flicker.
Yeah.
And that's because they're actually drawing two of the ghosts during one pass and then drawing the other ghosts in the other pass. They're never there at the same... They're never technically there at the same time.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah. For a while, I was a video gamer with a friend of mine, and there was a place... do you remember a place called Virtual World? Where you could go and you had a membership and you would actually play these games.
I only know of them in legend because there was none where I live, but I've heard of them.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, that was a very, maybe it wasn't, but the cool thing seemed to happen on the West Coast. That and skate parks and freestyle BMX parks and all that sort of thing.
Like everything we saw in the movies in the 80s was happening there.
Right. Well, I know that there was virtual world, they actually set up in different places. So I know that there was one, for example, in Dallas, Texas. And they had these two different games. In one game, you play so the idea was you would sit in this booth and you would have these three screens in front of you and these joysticks and you would move around. And in one game, you were playing a battle mech. And in the other game, you were essentially like a pod racer, basically. And you could pick different kinds of cars, different kinds of vehicles. I forget what the cost of the place was. I mean, it was something completely ridiculous. But the good news is if you played, they were all linked up over the internet or satellite or whatever the hell it was back then.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you could kind of play against other virtual worlds. And so if you actually played in tournaments and won them, you got these credits. And so there was a period of time there where I think I had what was effectively an unlimited number of credits to play as much as I wanted on my virtual world card.
Wow. I think, you know what? I think I recall at least the concept of that. I don't know if it was a virtual world franchise, but I do remember these pods. I think
Nintendo did one as well.
Really? Oh, interesting. Hmm.
Or something. Sorry, maybe not. But there was something similar to that as well.
Yeah.
And I was thinking it was Nintendo that was behind it. But
say it. Say it.
Well, I remember there was a it was in Piccadilly Circus where I forget exactly what it was. Maybe it was a Virgin store or something. I can't recall, but it was basically a bunch of video games, but they had this room where they had all these pods, and you didn't necessarily play the game. Like, you didn't insert quarters into the machine. You had a card, you know, like a credit card type of thing, and you inserted it into the pod, and it had not only credits on it, but it also had your information, and so information would be read from and stored on that card as well. So your kill ratio and your stats and all that sort of thing. And you'd go in, and it was you were like a mech of some sort, and you'd fight the other, I guess it was the other people in the room.
Right. And everyone was in one of these pods.
Right. Yeah.
You know, what's funny is that's actually come back. There are now some mech games in Japan where they're all set up like that. Like, there's a row of these pods, for lack of a better word, that you get in and you play with the people there. And you also play with people online. If, you know, it juggles it somehow, you know, so that it's always fair. But, so that's actually come back. It's almost exactly what you're describing.
I would totally pilot Gundam. I would. Oh, right. Yeah. I would certainly pay money to pilot a Gundam. That would be
sure.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was that kind of thing. It was actually kind of cool. I mean, it was actually super cool.
I remember everything being really slow, though.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, some of it was. There was a place here in San Francisco called the Sony Metreon. Mm-hmm. Which I guess technically, theoretically, is still here, although it might as well not be called
Metreon. It's just a cinema right now. Well, it's the Metreon. It's just that Sony has nothing to do with it.
Well, and but, you're right. And the theaters, they've sold to AMC right or Lowe's or some
AMC, and, I think. Yeah.
And the Sony store is gone, right?
Yep.
Right. And the PlayStation store is gone, and the place has been gutted.
It's a ghost town. It's really sad.
Well, so they're actually opening a Target. Target acquired it, and a Target is going to be like the first two floors, and there's going to be like a Chipotle and a yogurt shop. I mean, it's basically turning into a mall next to the Westfield Mall, which, as you know, the Westfield Mall is literally next door.
Right.
It's just like a mini mall.
I was going to say, when I stay in San Francisco, I stay at
that's so ruining for everyone.
Exactly. I stay at the Palomar Hotel, which is on 4th and Mission, above the, basically right next to the Westfield, but it's technically above the Old Navy. And so I know that very well.
Right. You stay there, and I would encourage you next time you come out to stay at the Mosser, which is next door.
Oh, the Mosser's quite lovely as well. I just have, I'm an Inner Circle Kimpton member, so they gave me like crazy stuff just for existing, which is pretty cool.
What did you just call it? A what member?
An Inner Circle member.
Of what?
Oh, of Kimpton. Okay, so...
it's a Kimpton
hotel. Yeah, it's a Kimpton hotel. So it's part of the Kimpton hotel chain.
I thought you said, I am in the Inner Circle of Kimpton.
Yes.
I was like, Kimpton? What the hell is Kimpton?
No idea.
Club I'm not familiar with?
No.
I feel so weird. I stay at the Griffin because I like it's all...
Because it's named Griffin, weird, for fuck's sake.
Well, there's
right,
that.
Exactly.
Who doesn't want to stay at something called the Griffin?
Well, there's also the... what is it? The Bijou,
yep,
which is totally cool if you haven't stayed there, basically every room is themed after a movie that was filmed in San Francisco. And so you have
That's,
you know, the
rad.
Bullet room, or the, you know, all these different rooms about, and it's, and there's actually, you can buy popcorn in the lobby, and there's a theater that shows two movies a night, two San Francisco based films every night.
Oh, wait.
Well, that's really cool.
Switch my alliance here.
Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. I mean,
of course, last time I was there, the Griffin was on fire, which I have video of that.
Oh, that's a bit of a thing.
Well, I'll talk about insider baseball.
Sorry.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's local to someone.
Where to stay in San Francisco when you are here?
Yeah. Well, you know,
Bijou is also honestly pretty cool, though. Can you imagine like a little movie theater where you can, you know, sit down and watch a movie?
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's great. Finding a decent cinema these days is nearly impossible. The whole idea of, yeah, okay, everyone's paying $13 to $15 to $18 to $23 or whatever just to get in. And then people are still on the phones, they're texting. I was in one film where some guy was actually talking on the telephone throughout the length of the entire film. It was totally ridiculous.
Yeah, somebody tried to pull that with me with Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So there was this backward cap wearing, I think that I'm in a gang, young girl, literally laying across two seats on her boyfriend on the phone, you know, just chatting during Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Ugh.
Now, after the opening credits for Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, I had already been pumped up enough to like inspire, you know, me to take out half the theater in a very violent way. And so that I got into the point where I guess I'm old and I don't know, kind of a weapons grade asshole. But I've gotten to the point where I just tell people, hey, take that shit outside.
There's no reason to destroy everyone else's good time.
Yeah, and I just think about, like, maybe it's not that much money to some people, or maybe they just really don't care, or they're just passing the time. I mean, I can't figure it out, but if you're going to pay $13 to $15 to go see a movie, and then you're just going to sit there bored and not watch the movie, I mean...
You can do that at home.
Exactly.
Or anywhere, but in front of me. I just... What the fuck?
But you got to figure too, they're like people sometimes, not really any of my friends per se, but I've been to some people's house to watch a movie and we sit down to watch a movie. And the next thing you know, it's a conversation. And I'm like, I came to watch the movie and I can't watch the movie and have a conversation and go in the kitchen. It's like, you don't understand the whole idea of linear storytelling, do you?
Yeah, I don't even have a pause button. I really, you know, once you start the film, sit down, shut up. You know, maybe if you've got to pee and you planned poorly, sure. But in general, you know, I don't even want to pause the film or do anything. You know, I came to watch the film.
Yeah.
Wow. That's fascinating. And I've bitched enough about this on social networks that I don't want to go too far into it. But this whole thing about, so you're an editor and you edit a show, and that show airs on TV. And during the show that you're watching on television are these... Well, first of all, there's a bug in the bottom right-hand corner, which makes me want to stab people.
Oof, yes.
Oh, makes me stabby.
Oh.
And then, right, it makes me stabby too. And then repeatedly in the face stabby. Okay, so there's a... Kevin Bacon's wife is on some show called The Closer, I think it's called, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that Kevin Bacon's wife?
Mm-hmm.
Kevin,
yeah, Bacon?
No idea.
Wife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
So The Closer has this lower left, lower third thing that it does where she comes out with a fucking flashlight and shines it in your face. And there's like a caution tape or a police line tape, do not cross. And she's like lifts it up and like pushes the flashlight forward while you're watching a fucking show.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about, Maggie?
Yeah, no, they're those walk-ons. They're absolutely freaking annoying because you cannot not be distracted by them, which is their intention. But it's like, great, I forgot what's going on in this show now. Yeah, it's crazy.
But how do
you... Well, if you're the editor of that show, could you imagine, like, you're at this really tense, beautiful moment that you spent, you know, a week trying to make sure that the emotional impact was proper and the people got a sense that, you know, maybe these two characters might get together, and then The Closer comes on with the fucking caution tape.
Right.
It just completely obliterates, you know, anything you did.
Yeah, or, you know, Rob Schneider walks out. Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's hilarious. Fucking get off my TV.
Well, I think they've even gone one step further where they actually have audio in them as well.
What?
Yeah. Where they...
Oh, yeah. They'll have like a whoosh.
Yeah, they'll have...
Something, yeah.
Or it'll actually be an intro to an advert where they'll have the stinger that comes out and the person or whatever is observing the action that's going on in the actual show that you're supposed to be watching.
Right.
And then they stop making comments, and then they stop the show, like they'll freeze frame the show, and then suddenly it's all this mini show in the lower third. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but this has got to stop. I mean, the rage I experience.
Oh, I would. That'd be it. I'd turn it off.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, that's the thing, and I wonder if these producers, and I wonder if the directors and the editors and everyone who actually crafted this show, I wonder what they think about it, because
they've got to be incensed by it.
Yeah, or they just say, screw it. They paid us. It's not that big a deal. It's just something we live with.
Because it's gotten to the point where, so there was a guy that was on one of my other shows, a guy named Zach Arnold, who became, he was part of the Bannon Way in the early days. And now he's the editor of Burn Notice. He started on season 4 because of the Bannon Way, actually. So
nice.
There's hope for people who do these indie things that are Kickstarter campaigns, right? The guy's on fucking Burn Notice. And if that's not an, Class A television show, I don't know what is, right?
I just got all of them on Blu-ray.
Yeah. So anyway, so I'm watching Burn Notice because I got into it. I started to like it. Talked to this guy. Zach and I have actually become acquaintances. He's like, man, I'm really proud of season 5. You got to watch season 5. So season 5 was, it was right before it was on iTunes. And so there was really no way to get to season 5 because it wasn't on DVD yet and all that. So let's just say, there are these ways in which you can acquire the show as it was aired, right?
Right.
So I have all of these AVI files and I'm watching, and I watched the first half of the first episode of season 5 of Burn Notice, and it was so infuriating to me that I put Burn Notice aside, finished watching Luther. Burn Notice came out on iTunes, and I paid $40 for season 5, even though I had it for free.
Oh, right. God.
Just so I would not have to deal with the way in which I was assaulted by crap on the screen while I was trying to watch this show that, somebody that I really respect edited.
Yeah.
Man, that's just egregious. There was one on not too long ago that was using like an IM kind of sound.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So.
Oh, my God.
So they're like, you can look at Twitter, and there was just like the, what the, every time it came up, people were like, what's going on? What is that sound?
Oof. Yeah,
that's
no.
That's ridiculous.
It's actively user hostile. And I just can't abide by that. It's, well, okay, that if you're going to go in that direction, I am not going to be a viewer.
Don't you think that it's going to get to the point, I mean, I know we're the edge case on this conversation too, about killing your cable, but don't you think it's going to get to the point, though, where iTunes, Netflix, Hulu, Crackle, you take, a large swath across those different ways of, having content delivered to you? Don't you think it's going to get to the point where people just take a choice and actually watch things in a different way? I mean, if Netflix had everything, Netflix would win. I can't, like, holy crap, Netflix is such a better experience.
But I have an instant rebuttal for that. That goes back to your guy in the theater. They're trying to get his attention. And if this guy can sit there with his girlfriend talking and she's on the phone and he's watching a movie and he can live through that.
He's watching a David Fincher film. Which your girlfriend to talk through a David Fincher film, you should literally have your fingernails pulled out with a fucking pair of pliers. You're an asshole.
So that's the kind of people these ads are trying to hit. They're trying to hit people who are already sort of disengaged to start with.
But is it really?
That's really my theory.
But at the same time, though, I mean, those are the people who are of a generation that have been always assaulted with various media and adverts. So they have an entire lobe of their brain that has been evolved to weed those out and to not even look at them or enter into their consciousness.
Oh, I never said they were affected.
No, well, there is that too.
Well, it's like a friend of mine has a MacBook Air and he has an iPhone, and his iPhone, the volume is like at 11, and his MacBook Air, the volume is at 11. And he gets a constant barrage of tweets and text messages. And he has like every social network in the world fucking texting him every time anything happens. And so to sit down with this person for 10 minutes or an hour or however long is to just be assaulted with beeps, just constant like bing, bing,
bing.
And he doesn't notice. He is literally fucking immune to this. And you know, I hate, this is the thing. Like, you hate to be that
Captain
guy.
Is this Captain Oblivious?
You hate, it's Captain Hyperbole is what I've named him. But you have to, I like literally have to say to him, turn your shit like on mute or put your fucking phone in your pocket. And like, he'll put it on vibrate and set it on the table.
Oh, so it just vibrates and makes a huge noise.
Yeah, while I'm working on my, you know, laptop or something. And it's just, you know, this constant like, meh, 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 you know.
Oof.
Hey, can you guys hang on a second? I got to get these kids off my lawn.
But I was going to say, that's exactly it. It's again, these things become distractions, not just to you, but to everyone else around you. Be the polite person. Turn it off, mute it, whatever. Do what you've got to do, but figure out such a way that you can be notified of something, but no one else notices that notification.
Yeah.
So the question is, am I a jerk for asking my friends to turn the volume on their laptop down? Or to put their phone on vibrate, or to, you know, while I'm trying to sit down and have a conversation with my friend.
No, absolutely not.
I do it too.
Because I feel like a fucking asshole. I got to tell you, I feel like such a jerk.
I do the same thing, which is, but I try to couch it in such a way that I know that they're better than that. So why don't they go and do the better thing? I found that that sort of psychological Aikido works fairly well.
That may be worse than what I do. So you actually say to your friends, look, I know you're better than this.
Yeah.
Can you turn your fucking thing off?
Yeah, pretty much.
You're a better person than
exactly.
this.
Well, because, you know.
Oh, man. Okay, I'm not a jerk.
Well, we all have a high, you know, opinion of who we choose to be friends. You know, no matter, you know, everyone does that. Every person does that. You know, so it's true, though. I mean, if I'm going to sit down and have a conversation with you, there's a level of respect that we both should expect from each other.
Right.
And that's not it. I mean, like you say, he's probably just not even noticing it.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. You know? Just like when I call him, he has the TV on in the background sometimes and he's trying to have a conversation with me. And I'm like, okay, do me a favor, mute your television, because otherwise, I swear to Christ, I'm going to hack into a satellite, target your house, and drop a fucking bomb on you while I'm talking to you, just so that's the last thing I hear, so you know what happened.
Well,
I'm going to switch it to Everyone Loves Raymond.
For me, the big thing is I will start also paying attention to that conversation on the television.
Oh, that's bad to hear.
Over the phone. So if I can hear it in the background, because it's barely audible, I'll actually devote more attention to that because I'm trying to figure out what on earth that is.
Yeah, in this case, it's not barely audible. It's a case where it's just a constant stream of noise.
Oof.
And part of that constant stream of noise is his voice.
Me, I just go, oh, I can call you back when you're not. I don't talk on the phone. What am I talking about? That's a lie. I don't even talk on the phone.
Yeah, who needs to talk on the phone?
Yeah, I don't go to the gym. I'm just naturally handsome.
There we are.
No, I avoid the phone. I hate talking on the phone.
I used to despise it. And I realized that it was one of those weird things where I would avoid it at all costs, including talking to clients. Avoiding client conversations is a real easy way to not get jobs. So,
I don't have clients, so they can all go screw themselves.
Well, in a way you do, though. I mean, because you serve the physics department, so...
Oh, sure, but if they call me, I'll have so much less information than what I need than if they... You know, send it through the proper channels.
Oh, right. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Usually it's clients who are calling up saying, hey, we need you to do something. And, you know, if my nervousness or trepidation or fear of phone calls gets in the way, then, you know, that job is going to go to someone else.
Well, I just think phone calls are horribly inefficient. I mean, I really enjoy talking to people that I'm friends with on the phone if there's something to talk about.
Well, yeah.
But if I'm working with someone, a phone call, it to me is just a long, complicated, drawn out interruption that I'm not, like Maggie said, I'm not going to have what they need anyway. They might as well send me an email, in which case I can respond in some meaningful way.
But if it's someone you're going to have a conversation with, that's different. Like I love when my mom and dad just call out of the blue and, hey, what's up? And we talk.
right, or friends.
That's a phone call, but not something that, hey, can you do this for me? I got this thing, and blah, blah. And it's like, no, just give that information to me and hang up. You don't need to call me.
Phone calls for me are a vector of getting to that person. So it's not so much having a long, drawn-out conversation with them. It's more along the lines of, oh, I will meet you at this place or whatever in 10 minutes. And then we'll have the actual conversation at the bar or over dinner or something.
Oh, that's text from me.
Right, exactly.
And if I text you, that doesn't mean call me.
Right.
Oh, God. I have friends that do that too. Hey, do you want to meet at 7 tonight? They pick up the phone and call you.
Bring, bring. Yeah.
All you had to do was say yes. That's all.
No.
Right.
And if, I mean, in this day and age, if you have a phone and you're texting me, you probably have a phone that can text.
Sure.
And even if you don't, you know, T9 takes 2 seconds to say yes. But if you do, which all of my friends do, they have some kind of, you know, feature phone or...
Let's just say it's some kind of iPhone, yes.
My next phone is not a phone.
Yeah, my next phone is not a phone. It's a phone. I don't remember what that's from. That's funny only to me in my head because I'm the one that remembers it.
I was wondering where you're going with that. I had no idea.
You know what the coolest thing, though, for me? So pretty much everyone I know has an iPhone. Just put that out there. But the coolest thing to me about the iPhone, I didn't realize this, but FaceTime is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm shocked at how often I use FaceTime to chat with people.
Really?
I have a lot of friends who don't live around here. Lara, for example, goes back to visit her family in Kansas for some reason that I cannot understand. Aside from the fact that it's her family, there's no other reason to go back to Kansas. When she's there, of course, I want to chat with her, right? But there's something really great about just being able to hit the FaceTime button and be like, oh, hey, how's it going? Because, you know, she and I have an intimate relationship, right? So being able to see the person you're talking to, and the same goes with my friends. You know, if I have a friend that I'm close to, I love being able to see them while I'm talking. There's something really great about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have underestimated how much they like using it. And I think a lot of people have poo-pooed it at the beginning and come to find out that it's actually useful for a lot of people and works very well.
Will Shipley poo-pooed it on my show and said that he thought it was just for sex.
Well, it's not just for sex.
And I was like, well, wow, do you... I have a lot of friends that I would really like to see, you know,
naked.
Some of which, you know, live in, say, Europe or someplace that I'm not going to very frequently. And so Skype is great, but the FaceTime is far and away better because you're already on the phone. You have that sort of tactile, immediate feel of being on the phone. So, you're not at your computer, right?
It's
a much more personal experience.
It's much more personal, yeah, because the device itself is personal, so it extends to that. But also the quickness in which you can initiate a FaceTime call is key. It's, you know, it's two clicks or two taps in order to get a FaceTime call. And whereas Skype, you know, you've got to load up Skype and you've got to make sure that the microphone's all good and you've got to make sure that, you know, your gain control is turned off and all that sort of thing. It's one of those things where it's just immediate. The downside, though, is that, and this is the downside with every sort of video chat as an idea, is that, God forbid, you can't multitask. You know, you when someone can see you, they know that you're distracted and seeing and taking a look at other things and doing other stuff. Whereas with audio or with text chat, you can be doing a multitude of other things and no one will ever know.
Right. And, you know, in a way, it's one of those things that we never saw coming, though. It's, you know, people always talked about video phones and whatnot, and they had the idea of the thing, you know, you walk up and it's the video is the phone, whereas this is more of a come to me when I want it kind of thing. But it's not interruption to technology, you know. It's like if you want to do FaceTime, it's there.
Especially if you do have an intimate relationship with someone, or even, you know, and you know, for whatever definition of intimate you want, Will Shipley included. The whole idea of being able to see someone, for example, Bill travels a lot for work. He's gone about 60% of the time. So for that time, I'm in the house alone, you know, very sad and lonely. But when he's available.
Picking up plants.
Exactly. Trying not to kill the plants, actually. You know, we'll.
Playing World of Warcraft.
Vacuuming the plants.
Vacuuming the plants, yes. Just being able to see him. It was really lovely because he'll be gone for 2 or 3 weeks straight.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know,
there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah. And even though he's not particularly, you know, computer hyper literate, he has been able to start up Skype and hit the giant green button and initiate or pick up a call.
I just haven't figured out how it's going to work out for those people who walk around the grocery store and the mall and Target and are on their phone like 8 hours a day, how it's going to work for them. I don't know what the hell those people have to talk about. But
well, you can also do an audio-only FaceTime.
Well, the interesting thing is about FaceTime, and I know it's not a bandwidth issue. You know, you cannot do FaceTime over 3G.
Oh, they still don't allow that?
I don't think so, do they?
No, I think it's a carrier concession.
Oh, that's interesting.
I actually, if I were Apple, it would be an Apple concession if I were there, because I would say that there is absolutely no reason why someone should be driving around or walking around with FaceTime going.
There's that. Because, I mean, they're already texting.
But there are a lot of places where Wi-Fi is not ubiquitous, though, where a lot of people rely on their 3G for their day-to-day internet connection when they're outside of their house.
Mm-hmm. It is weird that the carrier would make that requirement, though, because it seems like it would be in the carrier's best interest to allow FaceTime, especially AT&T, because they charge you for, you know, it's like $50 for 2 gigabytes of data or something.
Right, but they still can't handle the load.
Stupid.
Right, exactly. They have troubles handling the load. But it also could be that, you know, Apple wanted to build this Wi-Fi mesh network. Maybe that was, you know, well, if we leave this on there, then it would just be one reason to make our mesh network more interesting or more relevant.
Right. T-Mobile has voice calling, video calling over 3G and 4G, and it works really well. Jailbroken iPhones can also do the video calling on 3G as well, but obviously you have to jailbreak your phone and go through all the rigmarole, and, you know, for a lot of people, that's not worth doing.
Yeah, and it's funny, for as much of a hacker as I am, you know, and I talk about editing plist files and editing Borderlands and coming up with custom weapons and things like that. The idea of jailbreaking my phone, no,
well,
thank
it's a
you.
Different thing. Yeah, I mean, I want my phone to be reliable. I don't give a crap about, you know, a lot of things. I mean, in Christopher's case, for instance, to get to use my phone a different carrier, that's a whole different thing. Sure, I've done it for that reason, but like currently, I'm happy with my phone. I have the Verizon iPhone, and it works really well here. No signal in Cambridge for AT&T. Thanks, AT&T, you suck. But
well, we have full bars in San Francisco, and that is effectively a meaningless, you know, visual indicator.
Yeah, there's signal, but it's so overloaded that you can't possibly get on anything. It's same thing in New York.
AT&T, yeah, well, AT&T, I couldn't use my phone in my house or at work.
Oof, yeah, that's no good.
Yeah.
And you figure they'd have cell towers on campus.
They, every time, yeah, they were all like, oh, it shouldn't be like that. Let us have someone contact you. It's like everyone in Cambridge is complaining about this. And you
that
act
is my
like
favorite
it's my,
phrase in the world when you call someone and they say, oh, it shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
No shit. That's why I'm calling you.
Every user in Cambridge is complaining about this and like, I'm the first, right? Whatever. I've seen the Yelp forums.
Exactly. The problem is that they haven't, because they refuse to bother any sort of customer service.
Other than the having the someone say, oh, that's too bad.
The carriers, well, actually, I don't know if it can change too much, but if everyone is going to LTE, and unfortunately, even though everyone's on LTE or will be on LTE, I also think that some of the frequencies aren't going to be the same across all carriers. So we're still not going to have true ubiquitous or universal phones.
No, not unless Apple decides to pop a Qualcomm chip in that does multi-band, multi-everything. Yeah. My phone was stolen and I got a new phone. And the only way to get a new phone, I literally could not buy a phone from AT&T. They would not sell me one because I'm in contract.
Yeah. That's just totally ridiculous.
It's like, no, you're still in contract. You can't buy a phone. I was like, no, I don't want a discount. I just want to buy it. No, you can't do that. Really? Okay, well, let me go over to the Apple store, buy a phone, come back and give it a free SIM card then. Oh, yeah, you can do that.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, I bought this phone. And I think I may have mentioned this story to you guys before, but I don't think anyone other than you guys have actually heard it. I'm buying this phone and the guy at the Apple store says, well, what carrier are you on? And I said, well, I have AT&T as my provider, but I want an unlocked phone. He goes, okay, well, let me go get you an unlocked phone. And then he comes back, and I don't know, just because of the way my brain works, I went, wait a minute. Why does it matter what carrier that I'm on?
Well, don't they lock they lock it when you buy it.
Yeah, he goes, oh, well, there's actually three different kinds of phones, or four. And I'm like, okay. Yep. He goes, there's AT&T unlocked, there's Verizon unlocked, there's Sprint unlocked, and there's unlocked unlocked. And I'm like, well, what the hell is the difference? He goes, well, AT&T unlocked is an AT&T unlocked phone that once you put a SIM card in, locks to AT&T. But the unlocked unlocked phone, once you put an AT&T SIM card in, does not lock the phone to AT&T. It's literally an unlocked phone. And I'm like, well, is there a cost difference? No. then I'm paying full price for the phone. I told you mine was stolen. I'm not, you know. So for $750, how about the unlocked unlocked? Oh, okay. Let me go get that one instead.
Wow.
Yeah, there was a lot when I lived in Australia. There was a lot of that whole dodgy carrier lock sort of stuff. It's like, well, this phone's not locked, but it kind of is. You know, it's like, yeah, right.
Well, they all had carrier locks to some extent. But if you knew the right passcode, you know, you typed in the right sequence of numbers or what have you, it would unlock itself. But the rest of the majority of the rest of the world is GSM. So it became a fight of the carriers to try to get customers rather than forcing.
Well, and this AT&T unlocked, unlocked phone that I have isn't really unlocked anyway because I can't take it to any other provider because of the frequency, the band and everything that AT&T uses.
Right.
Yeah, you can't take it to T-Mobile. Well, you can take it to T-Mobile. The problem is that you'd be limiting your data rate to not 2G, which is ridiculous. Yeah.
Which is pretty crazy. Yeah. I don't know. I find the whole thing just really bizarre. There's a show on television called Portlandia, which might as well be called San Franciscia.
I hate that show.
Except it's in Portland.
I hate that show.
Okay, I love
the
show.
I love that show. And one of I was joking with Aaron about it today. I used to live there because he was joking about tattoos, and I had to admit, all my tattoos were done in Portland.
Yep.
Right. Biker's rights. So there's a funny, whether you like or hate Portlandia, there's an extraordinarily funny skit that everyone should pause this podcast right now and go watch.
Actually, we are looking for somebody. We're looking specifically for the mayor of Portland. And we are wondering if you can trace him using satellite technology to pinpoint his exact location.
And it's the Portlandia cell phone skit. It's where the guys are trying to buy a cell phone. And I'm not going to ruin the whole skit, but there's a part of it where they're trying to buy a cell phone and the person selling it says, well, you know, and then do you want the free unlimited data plan? And he goes, oh, yeah, sure. And he goes, okay, that's $19. And he goes, well, I thought it was free. And he goes, oh, it is free once you pay for it.
What was funny, though, in a way, is that skit, it was like a culmination of all the things that you've, over time, since you first had a cell phone till now, because some of it wasn't relevant, but it was still funny.
Yeah, it's well worth watching, and it's painfully accurate, too, right?
Also, I know where that store is.
Painfully accurate to living in Portland, or?
Painfully accurate to purchasing a cell phone. No, Portlandia is painfully accurate to being part of the left coast. I mean, especially the northern part, like San Francisco, Portland, maybe even parts of Seattle.
Yeah.
But it's like a friend of mine was watching Portlandia, who lives here, and it's kind of a San Francisco. There's a joke about San Francisco. I don't know if you've heard this joke before, but it's like San Francisco is like cereal. If you take out the nuts and the fruits, you're still left with the flakes.
Nice.
Right? So I don't believe that, but I believe that we certainly have our fair share. I mean, I think per capita, we definitely have our fair share of nuts, fruits, and flakes. But we also have a lot of people who are very into, it's like they latch themselves onto a movement, like with the ferocity of a velociraptor.
Right.
I mean, there's a heavy joiner contingency.
Believable when people get into shit. Like recycling has become a fucking epidemic. It's like the black plague out here.
Well, now you've got eight different bins.
Oh, right. And if you put your cardboard in the fucking non-cardboard bin, you know, because there's like plastic and metal and compost and actual rubbish. And then there's like the, you know, so you don't know whether things should go in compost or it becomes this like you need an actuarial chart to figure it out. Anyway, so I'm at Starbucks or somewhere, and I put my cup into this bin when I was done with my latte, but I left the plastic lid on it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the plastic lid goes on one. Anyway, somebody actually berated me about it, like for 5 minutes about like, do you understand what you're doing to the environment? You are just raping Mother Earth. Do you understand you're raping Mother Earth? Mother Earth is screaming because you are raping her. Like, just went off on me. And actually that was what they said to me.
I would have just walked right by them as they were talking. I'm like,
they got right in my face and they started out normal enough. And then it was like all of a sudden,
welcome to Crazy Town.
I know. It was like, we're setting up a lemonade stand in Crazy Town. Fucker, how do you like that? And so, you know, it's just like, it came out of nowhere. So my friend is a little bit like this as far as food, right? My friend's a foodie, but like a crazy, crazy foodie.
Is it local?
Right. So I showed
Portland
him the
local
episode.
Or
right.
Oregon
where it's
local?
Like, is that local? I'm just going to ask again. Can I ask just one more time? Is that local? And anyway, I showed him that skit and he goes, I fucking hate this show.
That's how you know it's funny.
Hit a little bit close to home.
Right. I was like, do you hate it because it's bad or do you hate it because it just punched you right in the nuts?
Yes.
Because I'm guessing that's what just happened.
Yeah, I liked the idea of the show. I thought it was really interesting, except that the more I saw of it, the more it seemed like it was this basically the same joke over and over again. I was like, but I haven't
to
seen
some
the
degree
cell-
it
well,
is.
I haven't seen the cell phone skit, so I'll definitely check that out.
Hey, let's ask Kanan about his guests. Now we've talked about people, you know. How do you get your guests? You know, it's like asking a writer.
How do you bait them?
Where do you get your ideas?
How do you bait them to get on your show? Do you drug them? Roofies? What?
Well, it's not just Mother Earth that I'm into. I don't know. You know, I've thought about that a little bit. I mean, how do I describe this? I feel extremely, and I'm being very serious about this, I feel extremely privileged. I have the fortune of having a lot of listeners, and they're very active, and I get lots and lots of comments, and I get lots of feedback, and that's cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think that does is I get a lot of my listeners will write in and say, hey, why don't you do a topic about Adobe Premiere? Or hey, why don't you do a topic about the Bannon Way? Or hey, you know, I get a lot of feedback, which is really good because that helps me keep the ideas going. And as you know, I basically do a show a week. I do Scruffy Thinking and then that post show and then Scruffy Thinking and then that post show. So even though Scruffy Thinking comes out every 2 weeks and that post show comes out every 2 weeks, it ends up being, for me, a show every single week. And that's hard to sustain, as you guys know.
Yes.
And
have a life.
Yeah, it's hard to sustain. It's hard to have a life. It's hard to, I mean, you know, if you're not in the business of making a podcast, if you're not Dan Benjamin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get paid to do it, and that's not your full-time job, then you have to find things that you're super, super passionate about, because otherwise you'll just pull your hair out, right? It'll drive you, it literally will drive you crazy. And so what I do is I just sit down and I say, oh, I find that person totally fascinating. And then I contact them if I don't already know them and say, hey, I do this show. I like this, 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 and this about what you're doing. I'd love to talk about it with you. Can you spare a couple hours in the next month? And what's funny is I think for the most part, every single person I've ever asked has said yes.
Are you also asking them to FaceTime sex you? Maybe that's what does it.
So I think the reason, I'm just going to ignore that. I think the reason that it works is because you're asking somebody to talk about something that they really care about. And I think people, you know, everybody deep down, I think people are really genuinely want to help. And I think that people love talking about things that are passionate, that they're personally passionate about. And so it just doesn't seem that hard. I mean, the perfect example is someone I mentioned earlier. I mean, I got Zach Arnold on that post show. The guy is the editor of Burn Notice. You know, it's like you look at that and you think, this is one of the most popular shows on television right now. And this guy decided to come on and just talk about editing. That is super cool to me.
That is very cool.
And it certainly engages your listeners as well. I mean, because they're going to be passionate about listening to this person because they're sharing their passion, you know, the guest's passion in it.
Right. The hardest thing for me, though, is the research, as you might imagine.
Sure. How much research do you usually wind up doing for a typical guest?
Actually, shockingly, I probably do a lot more than it seems like on the show. The thing is, So I think in order for a show to be really good and for the topic to seem natural and for you to just kind of have a conversation with someone, it's better to be familiar with the person's work than to just sit there and interview them, right?
Sure.
Because I could, Zach is a great example. I could have had him on and said, so tell me what you're currently working on. Okay. And for the listeners who don't know, what is that? Okay. Oh, who is in that again? You know, you could be that person. Or you could just start talking about the show and you know, sort of airdrop the listener into the middle of the conversation where you're not walking them through this sort of shit that they can look up. And part of that is just respecting that the listeners that you have of the show are smart and know how to use Google.
Right.
I always assume that people have things to say, too, that they haven't got out, you know, haven't given a chance to talk about. We haven't done a lot of guests, but I've done, you know, similar things where, you know, if you just let somebody talk about the stuff that they love, you're probably going to hear things that they haven't talked about on other shows.
Right. Whereas if you just sit there and hit them with the same questions that they always get. So another person I had on the show was a guy named Adam Liskor, and he is super great. Lonely Sandwich. He does sandwich video. He kind of got his start doing video by doing something called Birdhouse, right? And he did this video for Birdhouse, which was just brilliant. And I'm sure everyone who listens to this has seen that.
Yeah.
Probably. If not, now's the time.
Yes. So another pause. Definitely check it out.
We're driving people away from the podcast at every turn.
You know what?
Stop this podcast and then go.
I'm okay with that because, you know, if that gets them into something that they haven't discovered yet, then we kind of become associated with that by proxy. And I'm kind of okay with that.
Yeah. And our intention was never to become some giant podcast. I mean, it would be great. But, you know, we're this very reason. Christopher and I met up for the first time in person and sat down and talked. And he's like, yeah, this is right. Let's do a podcast. You know, that's where basically the way it worked. We'd been thinking about it and then sat down and we really got along and it was just like, let's do it.
Yeah. It just seemed like the obvious thing to do.
Not like, all right, we're going to have a meeting and I'm going to plan a podcast that could get lots of listeners.
And we'll monetize and we'll have merchandise and we'll do this. And it's like,
eyeballs.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, that's the easiest way to kill any love for a subject.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, of course.
Yeah, it's just, and that's why, you know, this little podcast that we've got is, you know, it's because we want to do it. And you know what? If we can't come up with a topic that we're really passionate about one week or whatever, then we skip a week. I do want to, you know, try to keep it consistent and such, but it is also a lot of work. And so if it's just not
going to pan out. That's my advice, by the way. If I had to give anybody any advice in the world of podcasting, it would be consistency matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's shocking how much it matters to people.
So, Kanan, thank you very much for coming on the show again. Where can we find you?
Yeah, my pleasure. Probably the best place to find me is at scruffythinking.com. I think I probably have about a zillion different domains that redirect to there. I think lifezero.org goes there. I think, you know, just... And recently, because I was looking at Maggie as my idol, and I was thinking, I want to be cool like Maggie. And so you can also go to about.me/Kanan, believe it or not. I actually put that up because I thought, well, that'd be kind of fun. I want an about.me. So
Maggie, what about you? Where can we find you?
Oddly enough, you can find me at about.me/Maggie McPhee. You can also find me on the Twitters at TANKGRRL.
And
you can find the rest of the stuff from one of those.
Right on.
Where can we find you, sir?
You can find me on the Twitters as well. I'm at Octothorpe, OctoThorpe. And you can also find me at localtype.org, my sadly underwhelming blog that I really should update one of these days. That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It For Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show as it really helps us out.
Are we in a podcast now?
I don't know. Oh, you know, I just wasn't into that film. I know, I'm the only one in the world. But
we are now officially divorced.